So what we've done on the countdown today is you've chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week in your view, and I've chosen my selections for the three most important. We're going to count them down like we do every week on the Federal News Countdown, and we start with...
Number three!
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to you, sir, is from GovExec. The headline is, HR pros offer bleak assessment of federal managers. This is a story on the Partnership for Public Service and Grant Thornton report, which you have in your hand. What is your number one takeaway from this?
Well, the report is called Bracing for Change, Chief Human Capital Officers Rethink Business as Usual. And I highlighted this. I thought it was an excellent report that had been done. It's one of a series that Grant Thornton and the partnership have worked together on. But I think about the challenging era we're in now with yet another continuing resolution approaching as we open the year. It's an election year with a transition looming, no matter who wins the presidency. Salaries are frozen. Bonuses are under scrutiny. Retirements are up. And the federal workforce is under attack in a way that I'm hard-pressed to think of a time like this that I can recall. So it's a challenging time to be a federal worker, a federal executive, and obviously a chief human capital officer dealing with all of those challenges when we actually are starting to see perhaps now the first wave of this retirement tsunami that has been talked about for a lengthy period of time. So I think the... The story I picked was focused on one aspect of the report, which really gave a very bleak assessment of agency line and operations managers in terms of their leadership and management skills. So at a time when that's really essential.
One part of this that I've dug into on a number of occasions, most recently with Ron Sanders and Jeff Neal, was the idea of where leaders in government come from. They're primarily promoted to leadership roles because they're technical experts, not necessarily because they're recognized for their leadership abilities or leadership potential. Do you see situations like this, numbers like this, data like this, changing anything in that way, or is that going to have to be part of a broader look at the general schedule and employment, recruitment, and retention and promotion in government in general?
In this case, I agree very much with the report's recommendations that really speak to this area. They really call for a change in the civil service recruitment and hiring system. I've said before, in many ways, I think there's a tremendous opportunity here that's presented within this period of crisis. You know, there's that old adage that the Chinese write the word crisis as a combination of danger and opportunity. And I think there really is tremendous opportunity in the fact that a new generation of Gen X, Gen Y, millennials will be given the opportunity to step up to leadership roles. They manage in a very different way than the baby boom generation, my generation did. They're much more collaborative in their style. They're certainly more tech savvy. So I think we ought to embrace that and see what we can do to accelerate and take advantage of that transition and the differences and the opportunities that offers for changing the federal workforce and changing the way in which we manage within the federal government.
We have a link to that Grant Thornton Partnership for Public Service report at federalnewsradio.com and Alan Baludis's third most important federal news story of the week. HR pros offer bleak assessment of federal managers is linked up on the in-depth page too. My third most important federal news story of the week is written by my colleague Jared Serbu, and under the headline Crisis of Confidence as USPS Posts $5.2 billion quarterly loss. And Alan, what jumped out at me about this is the idea that Patrick Donahoe is saying that not only is the bottom line issue here a problem, but the perception that it creates in the minds of the people we serve is also becoming potentially a problem. He tried to move to address that at this announcement this week, talking about the fact that postal delivery service won't be impacted. You're still going to get your mail every day. Nothing will change as far as the customer is concerned. But we've seen in the private sector, companies that are in financial trouble can only maintain that for so long until they do lose the confidence of the people that they serve. And what this really spoke to me about was the idea that leaders in all across the federal government should at least be conscious of that when they're trying to figure out how do we interact differently now with the people that we serve compared to how we've done it in the past when this specter of budget uncertainty is hanging over our heads.
Well, but of course, the difference is when companies face these kinds of challenges, they take actions to address them. We've seen in recent months several companies. Cisco, in fact, was one of them six plus months or so back that took steps to downsize their workforce because of some challenges that they faced. They cut some product lines. They sold off some companies that they felt were not core to the business. Look at the way the leadership at the Postal Service has been hamstrung by the Congress when they've tried to take actions to close offices, to cut back on certain kinds of services. And so we say we want these things to run like a business, but in fact, when they do, our legislative leadership restricts their flexibility to actually try to manage it in the same way a private sector firm would.
The example that I have used and will continue to use when it comes to the Postal Service is my personal example. I live near the processing center in Gaithersburg, and I can drive from my home to another post office, five different Postal Service locations within 10 minutes of my house. Now, that's more than there are Starbucks, that's more than there are McDonald's, and that's more than there are just about any other kind of establishment.
It's hard to believe there's more than there are Starbucks.
I know there is.
I'm stunned by that.
I know it's hard to believe, but I specifically looked because I couldn't believe it either. And I find it hard to believe that I need to be that well served by the Postal Service. And I wonder if the whole idea of that, rather than the rural locations, isn't what may be causing more financial problems for the Postal Service. Because, you know, if one of those were to close, I could just drive to one of the other ones. I understand where if you're the post office in a location that is very remote and where that person would not be able to have access to a Postal Service within a reasonable driving distance or travel distance in some other way, why a politician would want to fight to keep that open. Yeah. That seems to me to be a constituent service, someone fighting to keep 5 out of 5 open instead of 4 out of 5 for me and people that live in my area doesn't seem to be.
But you should really, you made an excellent point earlier as we were talking before the show that I want to be sure we capture here, and that is I think it's important for citizens and government executives to look at what's happening at the Postal Service as it deals with these fiscal pressures and financial duress at a time when the overall government itself is coming up on declining budgets, threats of sequestration. I know we're going to get into the the issues of the pressures on employees. You should deal with that point too, Francis.
Well, what I really believe is that I think if I'm sitting in an agency and I'm trying to get an idea of what's going to happen to me a year or 2 years or 5 years from now, I want to go back and look at what's happened to the Postal Service, how it got to where it is, and see if there are some lessons there that I can learn and apply. And I think that's the case. I mean, you've lived this. Is that a fair estimate on my part, do you think?
I think it is.
All right. My third most important federal news story of the week is crisis of confidence as USPS posts $5.2 billion quarterly loss. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. The second most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Alan Baludis when the Federal News Countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose. Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, Federal News Countdown this week. Features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Alan Baludis of Cisco Systems and by yours truly. And we are up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Alan Baludis is from The Washington Post. The headline is Romney's July fundraising outpaces Obama's. Now, that's the headline from the online version. You have the headline there from the print version, which was much more fun and interesting and sexy. What was this piece headlined on the front page of the print paper?
Sprint for campaign cash.
Yeah, that sounds much more exciting than.
Yeah, I didn't realize there was a difference between the print and the online versions in this, but. You know, we've talked about this before, Francis. I'm a kind of political junkie. You know, I came out of teaching political science to come down here to spend all these years in government. And unlike most people, I mean, I really love politics and the campaign. But I have to say, I'm starting to get fatigued. Of course, I live in Virginia, which is a swing state. You know, as you know, the election overall, the polls overall are close. But, I mean, most of the experts will tell you 40-plus states are really already pretty locked in. So the campaigns are just focusing themselves on 9, 10, 11 swing states. Which are the important ones, and that's where they're pouring all their campaign cash, and that's where you get the never-ending wave of commercials. So I thought this past week I was going to be able to escape, but it turned out I went out to Denver for some business meetings, and Colorado, of course, is also a swing state. And if anything, there were more ads on there than there are in Virginia. So I'm beginning to get worn down. As we move still with a couple of months left, but conventions are close, and then we're into the stretch, and we can move on to see which one will govern.
I hardly ever watch TV, I will say, but I saw a show on cable the other night, and I was absolutely amazed at how many spots there were, who they were from, how close together they had to be, just because if you're the person, see, there's normally a rule of thumb in broadcasting, especially in radio, that you don't put competitors in the same group of commercials, just as a courtesy, because you want their message to stand out in a particular area. So I was shocked that there were so many commercials, that there had to be pro-Romney commercials and pro-Obama commercials in the same cluster of commercials, just because that was the bulk of what this particular show was running. It was amazing. I hadn't seen anything like it in the past.
Well, you know, this will be a test for my love of politics.
Yeah, we'll
and
see how long it sticks.
These next several weeks to see whether even I can withstand the onslaught.
What does this mean for somebody at an agency where this is neck and neck. This is not like an election where everybody at this stage of the game has a fairly good idea of how it's going to turn out. And so we can start to think about what our work and our jobs and our mission might look like for the next however long. This is going to go right down to November. It could go, as we've seen only about 12 years ago, could go way beyond November. What does this matter inside an agency? Does anybody pay any attention to this for any purpose beyond the horse race part of it that we both enjoy?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously, if you're a senior appointee, you're thinking about, so what's going to be my situation after January? Am I going to be out, or do I have a chance to move up from an assistant secretary to a deputy secretary? But for most careerists, I don't think it affects their work at all. Probably some small group ought to start thinking soon about putting together transition materials, because even if the president is reelected, chances are they'll be, and a number of cabinet officials, Secretary Clinton, for example, have already indicated they're going to leave shortly thereafter, and you would expect many others would do the same if there is in fact a second term. They've served 3 or 4 years. We know the average lifespan is 18 to 22 months, so a number of them are going to leave. And a number are going to move up, and you've got to start thinking about that new group coming in. So, but for the vast majority of civil servants, I don't think it matters a bit.
Alan Baludis, the second most important federal news story of the week, is from the Washington Post. The headline is Romney's July fundraising outpaces Obama's. It's linked now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. More on the Federal News Countdown in a minute on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown every week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week, because of summer and so forth, I suppose, I could only get one expert, and me. Alan Baludis of Cisco Systems is my expert, and we're counting down the three most important federal news stories of the week that he's selected, and I've chosen three also. My second most important story is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jolie Lee's story, headlined, SSA Offers Early Retirement to 9,000 Employees. When I looked at this, Alan, I thought of Mike Causey's explanation that buyouts normally are timed for the beginning through the middle of a fiscal year so that an agency can maximize the amount of savings for that fiscal year. So I thought this was particularly interesting that we're almost at the end of the fiscal year. September 30th, of course, is the end of it. And so I thought this was odd, and I wondered if maybe this portends some kind of a new normal, that the rules that have applied in the past don't anymore because of the budget situation that we're in. Do you see something in this that jumps out at you?
No, I think it makes sense from a fiscal point of view. If you look down through the story, the date of separation for people, these are early retirements. They're not a buyout, so there's no kind of extra incentive. There's no extra payment by the agency. They take effect. The date of separation is September 30th, which, of course, is the last day of the fiscal year. So they'd be off the rolls at the beginning of the next day, at the beginning of the next fiscal year, and you'd begin to get the full benefit. But, I mean, I think this is an important story in a couple of ways. It shows the severity of the problem that I think a number of agencies are going to face with the budget cutbacks and the threat of sequestration. This has been a challenge at Social Security for some period of time. I had the chance to serve there on an advisory panel for Commissioner Astrew, and I know he and his executive team have struggled with this challenge for some period. But at a time, when, as we were talking earlier, when people, when there's all these issues about the federal workforce, if SSA loses this many employees, when you start to see the impact on the clientele they service, when you start to see the effect on the disability claims and the backlog and the length of time it will take, and so on. I think we will see both how important government employees and government service is and how devastating some of these cutbacks could be to the nation and the kind of services we expect and need from our federal government.
It's a good point that you make. I think it for a long time we've talked about cutting government in a very abstract way, and we've talked about the size of government in a very abstract way. And something that I have been pushing for a long time on this program is let's really quantify and let's really codify what smaller government looks like, and then we can have an honest discussion amongst members of Congress, inside the administration, and then leadership with the American people about whether is this really what you want. The idea of smaller government, lower taxes probably sounds good to just about everybody until we get to something like we talked about with the Postal Service earlier. Everybody is happy if the other guy's post office closes, right. And but if it's mine, don't touch mine.
And I did see a story this week. Neither one of us picked it as one of our top ones, although if I realized I was the only guest, I would have picked six top stories. But it's, you know, the government workforce is the smallest it's been in over 40 years. I mean, you have to go back to John Kennedy's time, almost the Kennedy Johnson era.
Is that raw numbers or per capita?
Raw numbers.
Wow.
And so, you know, government has become smaller. It's clearly more productive. We're going to get into, in my next story, to some of the tremendous accomplishments still. But, you know, it isn't a big government. It isn't an oppressive government. It isn't a large government per capita. And yet there is still this strong element in some segment of American society and in our political system that wants to demonize our government and government employees and civil servants and subject them to these kind of criticisms. And I think, again, going back to the earlier story, we really need to have somebody begin to speak out on behalf of the important role government plays and the important contributions that government civil servants make to this nation.
The discussion that I have been advocating about what government does and really quantifying what government does and discussing priorities actually shown through in one of the stories that we'll talk about later on in the countdown. We'll discuss that concept later, too. My second most important federal news story of the week is Social Security Administration offers early retirements to 9,000 employees. Jolie Lee's story on federalnewsradio.com. All of our stories in the countdown are linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important story of the week is selected by Alan Balutis next on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rowe. You're listening to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week with my friend Alan Balutis of Cisco Systems choosing his three most important federal news stories of the week. And I've chosen stories two, and we are up to on the countdown this week.
Number one!
The most important federal news story of the week as selected by Alan Balutis. Now, again, the Washington Post headline in the hard copy of the paper is different than the online version. The hard copy version, or the online version, is with NASA Mars rover Curiosity safely on surface, time to take inventory. But the paper headline is much better. What is it on
NASA? A touchdown celebration.
Yeah, see, that's much cooler. And I don't know why they don't give us the cool headlines online. I guess because you paid, what, 75 cents for your paper.
At least.
I just got it online for free. But why is this important? What struck you about this story? I think I know where you're headed with this, but just tell me.
Well, I think you know as well. What a tremendous accomplishment for the federal government, for NASA, an agency that, like SSA, is under fiscal pressures and duress and faces real challenges in the coming year in terms of cutbacks in their budget and their staff and their centers. But I just love this quote in the article from John Holdren, who's the White House science advisor. He's the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. He said, if anybody had been harboring doubts about the status of U.S. leadership in space, well, there's a one-ton automobile-sized piece of American ingenuity, and it's sitting on the surface of Mars right now. And that's after a 352-million-mile voyage from Earth. What a tremendous accomplishment by our government, our civil servants, and the industry partners who worked with government to achieve this. To balance out some of these other stories that often focus on the criticism and the duress and the conference expenditures and the like, I was just thrilled to find a story that really spoke to, I think, the wonderful work so many of our civil servants do and the wonderful work overall that our government does.
The money is something that you knew was going to come up in this, and this story in the Post addresses this and I think puts it in a very interesting context. Its $2.5 billion price tag has drawn some criticism, but after nailing the most difficult planetary landing ever, NASA and Obama administration officials appear to believe the dynamic has changed. After the landing, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden told a cheering crowd that the mission as a whole cost the equivalent of a single movie ticket for everyone in the United States. This is a quote, and this is a movie I think people want to see, he said. And when you think about it in that respect, it's a lot, maybe a lot of these cost discussions that we have, what things cost, maybe start to shift a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. And I think if you've seen any of the initial, these are photos and data and insights on Mars that are going to come back hopefully for at least 2 years or so. They're really thrilling. And I think we talk about some of the inspiration derived from some of the American successes at the Olympics. I think the successes on Mars with Curiosity and some of the achievements and breakthroughs that we will see in the scientific realm as a result of this are inspirational and inspiring as well.
The inspiration part of this is something else that's mentioned here. The president of the California Institute of Technology that runs the JPL says, experiencing that remarkably complex but perfect landing, then watching the rover in the months ahead can't help but excite young people. A reference to the space race in the 50s and 60s that inspired a lot of people to get into government service and also inspired a lot of people to go into science and math and technology disciplines, right, that yielded the technological revolution we've seen.
We constantly talk about that STEM issue, the science, technology, engineering, math, the shortage of people who are going into those fields. And I think you're absolutely right, Francis. This really ought to do something for children in school today to drive them toward careers in this, just to see the kind of excitement that's pictured on the front page of the Post with some of these NASA scientists celebrating as the landing occurs.
And a little sidebar to that, hold that picture up and hold it to the microphone. People can see it a lot better on the radio.
Is that too close? Everybody see that well
but,
now?
But think about the video. If you didn't watch it at, 2 o'clock in the morning, we can consume media now in such a way that's dramatically different than when the astronauts landed on the moon. My son didn't watch it live. He's 12 years old. He watched the video after the fact. But he saw the euphoria in mission control when they knew this thing was down and they were getting signals back from it. And he's going to go back to seventh grade in a couple of weeks. And I can't imagine that part of the discussion in Some of his classes won't revolve around, from the kids, not from the teachers. What do I have to do to be able to be involved in something like that? Another sidebar that I thought was tremendously enjoyable was, have you followed any of the coverage about the guy in the Mohawk that was involved
there? I've seen a little bit of that.
Okay, yeah. And then sitting next to him was a guy that looked like he just walked back from a Grateful Dead concert. And what I saw in that picture was not the characteristics of those individuals necessarily, but I saw a very diverse group of people from different backgrounds, different nationalities, all converged, collaborating on this very exciting, the absolute most cutting edge mission that you could possibly be involved with. And it's just a tremendous positive, I hate the term feel-good story because I think it's so hackneyed and cliched, and yet, if there is such a thing anymore, I would have to say this was it.
Well, between the feel-good spirits coming out of the successes in the Olympics and this, it's been a pretty good week so far, Francis.
Good selection as your most important federal news story of the week. The headline online at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, linked up through the Washington Post, is, with NASA Mars rover Curiosity safely on surface, time to take inventory. You can read that and all of the stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. One more story to cover on this week's Federal News Countdown. We'll do it next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Alan Balutis of Cisco Systems and yours truly. And my most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com, Jason Miller's story from Wednesday, headlined Major Changes to Performance Management in OMB Budget Guidance. His conversation with Shelley Metzenbaum of OMB and my conversation with Robert Shea of Grant Thornton and formerly of OMB. The part of this, Alan, that I think is the most interesting, this is regarding the updating of the A11 circular that agencies use.
I noted, how wonkish of you. I went for something so pedestrian like a Mars landing, and I missed out on the A11 updates.
Methinks you might be pulling my chain.
The most important story of the week.
Wow.
But
rattle in my cage. I can't believe it. The gall of you, my friend.
Unmitigated gall. Raising the effrontery.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. The horror. The idea of the reason I thought this was so significant, though, is the way in which OMB is asking the cut question. The last several years, the direction has been, tell us what 5% or what 10% in one year's case you would cut. This year, the question is being asked, or the direction is being given somewhat differently. This year it is, show us the 5% of lowest priority spending at your agency. And as you and I discussed during the break just a moment ago, when I ask people, when I'm interviewing somebody, and I ask them a question that might be similar but different, I'm hoping for a different response. And I wonder if that's not the case here. And I wonder, based on your experience formulating budgets at agencies, whether you think they'll get a different result.
I think their reason for doing so is exactly that. I think they're posing a very similar question in a different way to see how the answer squares up with past responses and to begin to probe for any dissonance and discontinuity in those responses. But I think both, you know, Robert in his earlier incarnation at OMB, Shelley Metzenbaum today with a similar portfolio of responsibilities, are trying to get in a different way, in a more analytical fashion, in a more fact performance based fashion, at that same kind of issue, with an attempt to rationalize and improve the management and budget process.
The idea that we would ask First of all, what it seems to me this is going to require is not just trying to figure out the 5% that we could live without, but it's going to require analysis of 100% of the agency in fairly short order. Now, that's not a task I can imagine that will get done for fiscal 2014, but it strikes me that it will get people aware of the fact that this is going to come soon. Now, we've heard some talk in Congress. Senator Coburn has proposed a bill on the Senate side, Congressman Issa on the House side, to essentially require an inventory of everything that each agency does so that priorities can be established in this way. It strikes me a couple of things. First of all, the administration wants to get a jump start on that and have agencies doing that work already, even if Congress never gets around to mandating that through legislation. The other thing that strikes me about this is by asking this question in a different way, agencies will really have to come to terms with the fact that there are some things that we're doing now that we're going to have to cut loose. And I like that because that means this whole idea of more with less may finally go where I think it deserves to go, which is in the garbage can. What do you think about that?
Well, again, I think you got to start on this journey. I think that's what Shelley and Jeff Zients are trying to do. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're in all likelihood we're going to revisit the budget submission after the election in November and in January, regardless. And clearly, the budget process in the U.S. government is broken. It's flawed and it's broken, and we need to start a discussion about how we can begin to improve it so that it's done on a more factual, informed, and analytical basis, and it actually produces a budget in time for the start of the fiscal year. We see the long-term implications of our decisions, both financially and in terms of the performance of government. And I think this circular starts us in that direction. And I commend Shelley and her staff and Director Zients and the others who have contributed to this. Robert, who started the ball rolling on this, both in government and in his service on Capitol Hill.
I want to apologize to you for not choosing something as grandiose as yours.
I know you did this to just make me look good as your guest. Well, I appreciate the sacrifice on your part.
That really is a high priority. Your appearance on the show and how people perceive your expertise is one of my most important goals in this program.
As it should be.
It is always great to see you, my friend. I love having you on the program. Thank you very much for being here.
I always enjoy it. Thanks so much for having me, Francis.
The most important federal news story of the week, as I have selected on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, is a headline, Major Changes to Performance Management in OMB Budget Guidance.